Albert Matthew Francis Whitty was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1923, raised Catholic in an early 20th century row house by his mom and extended family under the shadow of coal-fueled paper mills in Erie, Pennsylvania. Coal, he remembered, was the prime source of home heating fuel at the time, and it was stored in the basement next to the furnace.
And each August, you'd get a ton of coal and hope that it was enough for the winter. It was dirty, dusty. The factories, like the Hammer Mill Paper Company, they had these smokestacks, and they were using coal, and you hung your clothes out to dry in the backyard, and then all of a sudden you'd see that smoke coming, and you'd run out and capture them before they got all dirty and needed to be washed again. It was a lot of fun in a way, but it was a different type of challenge to day-to-day living.
While his mom worked as a telephone operator, Whitty played in the streets, lots of fast-pitch softball. Their neighborhood kids, he said, couldn't afford baseball equipment. He played first base because he couldn't run fast, and his East Avenue grocery team made the semifinal state championship, setting him up for a future career in sport, which you'll hear about later. During that era, Whitty remembered the various vendors who also roamed the streets when he was a child.
There was the rag man. I don't know if you ever heard of the rag man. He'd come down with, he had his horse and a wagon. We had the old tinkers. Have you ever heard of a tinker? Do you know what a tinker is? Mm-hmm. They were supposed to be bad people. I think gypsies. But he'd come up, walk down the street, and every house he'd stop. Do you have any knives to sharpen? And we had door. You had all the door-to-door people. You had your bread man, your milkman. All of that was still the common way of living.
Whitty attended Catholic school as a boy, where the nuns instilled in him a love for reading, but no compass for the sciences. They didn't really teach it much, he says. One of the smartest boys in the class, he was considering college, but was drawn into World War II after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. To avoid being drafted by the Army as an infantryman, Whitty enlisted in the U.S. Air Force, which was really disorganized, he said, at that time. Along with a cadre of crop dusters, he trained to be a bombardier at several places, including Fayetteville, his first visit to the Ozarks. He was dispatched to southern Italy, where a squadron was based with 10 crews and 9 airplanes, called a complement. They took turns with other complements, flying missions and formations of 36 bombers over Germany, dodging enemy anti-aircraft flak detonated from ground cannons.
Once you flew 35 missions, you had finished what was called your tour of duty, and you were eligible to be sent back to the States for reassignment. That was, let's say, the preferred method of getting out of there. Mm-hmm. The other was, of course, of being shot down. So now our airplanes were routinely hit. I was never hit. Some of my crewmen were wounded.
They chose targets not by radar, but according to the weather, Whitty said, cloud coverage prohibited strategic carpet bombing.
As I remember, my first mission was over a town called Friedrichshafen, which was famous because that's where the Germans built their Graf Zeppelins. And it had been turned into an airplane factory. And we bombed the factory. All the bombardiers dropped when the number one guy dropped. So you would be waiting for see him drop, and then you would drop the bombs immediately and hope for the best. And then you try to get your butt out of there because they were usually going to shoot at you. And so you would wheel out of there as fast as you could and head home for safety. So that's the way the formation went. Well, meanwhile, when you took off plane after plane, is you circled the air until you all got a formation and you headed wherever you were going. So you bombed your target. Let's say that was the number one target and you bombed it. And there would be in the back airplanes, there would be cameramen. Clark Gable did this on 5 missions, is you'd have a camera in a hole in the airplane in the floor, and you'd have a camera there, and you'd film where the bombs had hit, and so you could then go home and look at whatever damage you had accomplished, and so you'd go to debriefing, and at debriefing you would say, well, what happened to you, and you would give them your experiences and relate to it, and by then, you'd been up since 3, or now it's probably 14, 15 hours later, and then you've had a hard day.
Witte described Air Force rations as horrible, lots of powdered eggs, for example, and he looked forward to care packages filled with cigarettes and Fig Newtons. His last mission was in 1945, routing the Germans out of Florence, Italy, for which he got a Distinguished Flying Cross. The handsome young man with the shiny Brill-creamed curls came home healthy but ravenous for good American food and a fresh start. After earning a master's and PhD from the University of Chicago and graduating from University of Wisconsin School of Law, Witte became a professor at the University of Arkansas School of Law in 1957. He remained a member of the faculty until his retirement in 1994. He occasionally teaches still. Many Arkansas lawyers and neophyte politicians were trained by Professor Witte, and both Hillary Rodham and William Jefferson Clinton, a Fresh Roads scholar, was hired by him to teach at the law school.
I'm sure he was prepared, but he was brilliant, as you would imagine. But the students knew that his heart wasn't in it, and he wasn't always as prepared as he should be. About 15 minutes after we met, I was all in favor of hiring him. I was all in favor of being his campaign manager and his advocate, which I was. I later, and my boys would follow him anywhere, and he was up around introducing himself to all the diners at the Fayetteville Country Club, because, as we later found out, the reason he came here was to test the waters for running for Congress.
And later became the 67th president of the United States. As a law professor, Witte says he was stern and occasionally hollered to make a point. Witte recalls socializing with another up-and-coming couple, David and Barbara Pryor, at the Elks Club one evening in Fayetteville.
And I was oblivious, and what do y'all want? And I knew what my wife wanted, I knew what I wanted, so I'm looking over at the Pryors, and David's kind of looking a little blank. And Barbara whispered in his ear, and he said, gin and tonic. And she later told me I had bought him his first drink.
A gin and tonic for a man who would later serve as the governor of Arkansas and U.S. Senator, and after provide the seed money for the David Pryor Oral History Center, which served to document Albert Witte's life. Scott Lunsford is the center's associate director. It was his idea to record the retired law professor. Lunsford first encountered Witte while working in university relations, and Witte was president of the NCAA during what Lunsford called the Jack Crow regime of the Razorback football program.
Jack had a very innovative and probably one of the best coaches shows in the nation, although he only lasted a few years. It was kind of a video magazine, and one of the innovative things that he did was he allowed a broadcast camera, a camera capable of producing broadcast footage, within the team area, the bench, and also in the dressing room before and at halftime and after the football games. This was pretty much unprecedented access. In fact, it went against the grain of the NCAA rules of cameras being within the team area.
But as president, Witte allowed it. He also instigated reform in college athletics, Lunsford said.
I believe that he was the last president. They're now chairman of the NCAA. He told me that his proudest work there was trying to level the playing field for women's athletics. They were treated as basically a stepchild next to men's athletics, and he really fought hard and succeeded in raising that bar for women athletes in the NCAA. And I'm not sure that the next president or one of the next highest officials was actually a woman that came along, so he's quite proud of that.
Al Witte told Scott Lunsford that, in his opinion, the NCAA as an institution is not the end-all, be-all.
It's like they think there's a government. Now it used to be in Kansas City, now it's in Indianapolis. It's like a separate nation, you know, like Star Wars. It's an enemy nation that controls all this stuff. It doesn't. There is no NCAA. The NCAA is the member schools. Coaches go around frequently saying, "You, that damn NCAA, you realize they've got a rule that says that I can't do this and I can't do that. MCA." And what they don't know is that rule was passed by their athletic director or their president.
That's who the NCAA are the people that vote the rules in.
To date, the team at the Pryor History Center's logged more than 750 audio recordings, 150 video recordings, and Professor Al Witte's was the longest, 14 hours. His colorful recollections about his time with the NCAA, the many people he taught and met as law professor at the U of A, and his remarkable military record can all be read and portions of it heard online at pryorcenter.uark.edu. And by the way, he says he's been treated really well in Arkansas, for which he is grateful, and he calls this place an isolated mountain paradise. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.